Hello, this is Dr. David Friedman, host of To Your Good Health Radio. Today, we're diving into a topic that touches both the mind and heart, dementia. This condition impacts not just cognitive function, but the very fabric of family and society, affecting 55 million people worldwide. We're honored to have the esteemed Jane Seymour with us today. Her powerful performance in the new film Ruby's Choice sheds light on the personal struggles and family dynamics of living with dementia. Through her portrayal of Ruby, she offers a voice to those on this challenging journey and highlights the enduring spirit of human connection. The movie also showcases the valuable contributions that those with dementia can offer, despite the obstacles they face. Stay tuned. Jane Seymour joins us next, and it all starts now.
It's To Your Good Health Radio with number one best-selling author and renowned wellness expert, Dr. David Friedman, changing lives just for the health of it.
Our next guest is a distinguished and multi-talented Emmy and Golden Globe award-winning actress. Her illustrious career spans Broadway, TV, and the big screen. She's known for her critically acclaimed role in Dr. Quinn, Medicine Woman, and recently starred in Netflix's top-performing film, The Irish Wish. You may also recognize her from The War with Grandpa, Live and Let Die, and Wedding Crashers, and of course, my all-time favorite movie, Somewhere in Time. Currently, she's starring in Harry Wild, airing on Acorn TV and BBC America. Beyond acting, she's a best-selling author of over a dozen books and an accomplished fine artist inspiring the Open Hearts by Jane Seymour Drury line. Her contributions are as profound as they are diverse. Today, she's here to discuss her latest film, Ruby's Choice, which sheds light on the complexities of dementia. Welcome to the show, Jane Seymour.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Oh, so glad you could join us. Now, I watched Ruby's Choice, and your performance, I have to say, was stellar. Fantastic job. Share with us, what drew you to this role of Ruby, and how did you prepare for the complexities of her experience?
I read the script, and I just thought, I've seen a lot of movies about dementia. In fact, I made a documentary about Glen Campbell called I'll Be Me, which was a great documentary. But when I read this script, I thought, this really shows you the entire world of what that diagnosis is. It shows you, and I really felt I could play Ruby, but, you know, Ruby's a matriarch of a family, and as she starts to really suffer from dementia or Alzheimer's, what you really see is the impact it has on the family. And in this particular movie, it was so accurately depicted, so brilliantly. And I couldn't believe it when I first read it. And I found out that the writer has been working in that field for 30 years. So this is really as real as it gets in terms of the impact it has on the person, the entire family, what the resources are, what the choices are. And as you can see in our story, there are light moments. There are moments where you want to cry. And at the same time, you see that Ruby impacts the entire family in a positive way rather than just a negative way. I just thought it was very enlightening to what that journey is for everyone involved.
Yeah, I know dementia, it's a condition that affects not just the individuals you'd think, but their entire family. I think that film really portrays that. Share how this film explores the dynamics between Ruby and her family members as they navigate through this challenge.
Well, as is normal, you know, there's always the different stages of the disease. When Ruby starts having dementia, you know, her daughter feels like, well, you know, mom's getting older. Mom sometimes forgets things. She doesn't have Alzheimer's or dementia. She just forgets things. And then the next thing we know, she's burnt down her house and nearly herself in it because she's forgotten she put something on the frying pan. And we also see her being taken advantage of by telephone, you know, people on the internet and the telephone trying to upsell her to something she doesn't want, or she's trying to fix a computer, but actually it's not a computer, it's her microwave. We can see right off that she definitely has a problem. But after she now has to move in with her daughter has to figure out how can they all go to work and go to school and have a life and leave Ruby there. And they think that's safe to do. But of course, after the first day, they realize Ruby accidentally has killed two family pets by overfeeding or letting the bird out of the cage or whatever. And so the family has an even worse problem because another member of the family is going through a divorce and has to come and stay with them, and they have very limited means and very small amounts of space. So now Ruby has to sleep with her granddaughter, and her granddaughter is a wonderful student, doing really well. But now, in trying to look after Ruby, she has to leave school. And she has to look after Ruby because no one else can. And there's a whole dynamic there. But we also see Ruby in the middle of the night in the same bedroom as this very young girl, talking to the young girl as if she was her husband. Well, we now know in the story, husband's been dead for 5 years. But, you know, one of the most important things with anyone with dementia is you never tell them they're wrong. If they think they're going to see their husband any minute and you know they've been dead for God knows how many years, you don't bring them back to the present and have them go through that misery all over again. And we see that happen with this young girl. She says, Grandma, Grandpa's been dead a long time. And you just see this poor woman absolutely go through the initial stages of unbelievable grief. Until the granddaughter lies and just said, you misunderstood. I just said he was out. He'll be back in a minute. You then see the grandmother regressing and going back to being a 20-year-old and talking about stuff that the granddaughter knows nothing about, which we then find out is about the circumstances of her own mother's birth. And we find out that the mother was actually adopted. So there are all these secrets in the family, all these issues, all these things that are like elephants in the room. Then inadvertently, Ruby gives of her wisdom, even in the depths of dementia. We see her losing the plot, and we see this young girl realizing by putting music on from that era that she can get her grandmother to come out of her deep, dark tunnel and suddenly get up and start dancing as if she were 20 again. We can see her when her daughter digs in the garage for some paints, and she finds that Ruby can still paint. And we see how they can connect and when they can't. And then ultimately, the real issue is they cannot physically take care of her anymore. And she needs to go into a home. But this has to be a choice that Ruby makes rather than them. And by some miracle, Ruby makes that choice. So basically, I've given the whole movie away.
No, it's great. You got to see you. Was there a particular moment or scene in the film that was especially impactful for you to perform?
Gosh. I think when Ruby cannot find the toilet in her own daughter's home and finds herself opening the larder and looking for the toilet and then realizes that she's wet herself. And this was just so demeaning and so terrifying and so frightening. I think that was a big one. And then I think there was when she, in her sleep, she has these dreams where she finds herself talking to her husband, who we now know is dead, and really kind of living out her past in real time in front of her granddaughter. I think those were very big moments for me.
Yeah, I have many patients dealing with the hardships of caring for a parent with dementia, and the biggest challenge they face is maintaining patience. And for those that didn't see the film, share how your portrayal of Ruby might help people harness some needed patience when navigating through this difficult journey. I was so impressed with that theater concession stand owner. He was so patient. It was like he answered the same question each time, just friendly. I like that. That was really, who would have thought that from somebody that's just, you know, the concession stand guy?
Exactly. So if every day she comes in and wants to watch the same movie and doesn't remember that she's seen it the day before or 25,000 times, he just says, oh, that's a great choice. Yes, I think you'll like it. And she's so happy. So really, basically, there are rules with people with dementia. Number one, do not correct them. There's no point. They're living in the past. They're not in the present moment. In the present moment, you can give them love. You can hug them. You can hold them. You can play music to them. You can touch them. You can stroke them. You can massage them. You can laugh with them. You can listen to what they have to say because they want to be heard and agree with them. And then if it's something that you can't fulfill or you know is wrong, you divert. You just say, yes, oh my God, you're so right. Well, hold one sec. Would you like a cup of tea? Because I'm just thinking I have a cup of tea. And then all of a sudden you diverted them to something else. So, hey, do you want to take a look outside and smell the roses? Let's go. Whatever it is you can do, you bring up another subject. And I think that's one of the things that works so well in this film is you actually, and I've heard this from audiences, you come away with actual tools of what to do and what not to do. And as desperate as you are to realize that this person doesn't know who you are, when you see them, you say, hey, Mom, it's me, Jane. You know, instead of like, Mom, don't you know who I am? Or getting desperately upset because she doesn't know who you are. He doesn't know who you are. but you can trigger back into something, or she or he will know that you're someone that they trust and love because of a gentle touch, a reassuring smile. You have to find your way in, but you're not going to get the person back. There'll be glimpses, there'll be moments, and those moments may be terrifying for the person who has Alzheimer's. So bear that in mind too. You don't want to bring them into something that's going to cause them anxiety, because they're already anxious. They cannot, just from within, having played it, you just can't reach that name. You can't reach that memory. You can't reach who or what's happening. It's just out of reach. So think of it like there's a baby and you see something, you don't even know what it is, but you're just trying to reach it and you can't. And your frustration is that somehow some part of your DNA tells you that you used to be able to.
Yeah, so true. I know the film also shares how individuals with dementia can still make meaningful contributions. What's your thoughts on that message and its importance?
Well, I think that's really huge. People with dementia actually can, if you can find a way to bring them into the now, which is the thing they have trouble being in, because they can't assess what the now is. So they mostly live in their past. If they're in the now and you play a piece of music for them, or you dance with them, or you give them something delicious to eat, you are in the now, and that's what you can do. And they give back by appreciating that. And it is an incredibly difficult job to be a caretaker, incredibly difficult. My aunt died caretaking for my uncle. She absolutely refused to let anyone help. And so, you know, like they always say, if an airplane's going down, put your oxygen mask on first, because otherwise you can't help the person you're with. That's exactly the case with being a caregiver. You have to find some way to have at least a moment or two where you can take care of you, where you do something for you. And when you feel that you've done something for you, then you're better equipped to take care of the person you're taking care of.
Yeah, interesting. I have a patient who's grown very impatient and said, "Mom, you just had lunch. Why do you want lunch again?" And she doesn't. And I said, "Try this. Get your camera on your phone, videotape her having lunch, and then I want lunch. Mom, look." And then the mom would look and see you already had lunch, and it's, "Oh, I did." There's no argument. There's something about seeing yourself do it that somehow synapses the brain, and then the mom was, "Oh, yeah, I had lunch." It was really a neat little thing, and she's so happy because rather than, "Oh, you had lunch," or "You took your pills already," and, you know, so I don't know. I don't know any science behind it, but it was just an idea, and it's working. So I think it's signaling a different part of the brain, which is real good. How do you hope the film will influence the conversation around dementia and the support systems available for those that are affected by it?
Well, as you said, the statistics are ridiculously alarming. Basically, I think it's 1 in 2 of us over the age of 70. So I think everybody needs to learn about it. And I think this is a movie that should be shown in schools. I think young kids need to know, because this is a multi-generational experience. When grandma or grandpa has dementia, your parents are now full on trying to figure out what to do. And you are now in the mix. And it's entirely possible also that financially, you may not have money to go to college. You're going to have to learn the reality of life, that when people are older, the next generation, your parents, are going to have to figure out what you're going to do. And then you can look at it and say, okay, this is what I can do to help here, or this is what I can do to be compassionate to the grandparents. It's just real life. Sadly, it is real life. And I think it's an issue that has to be dealt in a gentle way to a younger generation, but it's much worse to not tell them and to have not understand why grandma or grandpa is being angry or violent or causing, you know, the parents to have problems maybe in their marriage or in their life or in their own patience or in their own ability to function. It's an elephant that has to come out of the room.
I think this film does. It brings the elephant out of the room and brings it. People can discuss things now. It's like it brings it to the forefront. And it's like, I'm not alone. Wow, this film is this what I'm going through. And I don't know. I just think that that creates a group effort. There's more people dealing with it. And you know what? As you said, you know, you look at older people, that could be you. Be compassionate. You're young now and you think your life's going to never end, but you're going to be old and you better treat them like you want to be treated. That's how I look at it. Let's take a step back in time. You started one of my all-time favorite movies. I mentioned it, Somewhere in Time, and this film continues to enchant audiences 4 decades after its release, and you and the late Christopher Reeve created such an amazing on-screen chemistry. What lessons or memorable experiences did you take away from that collaboration?
I would have to say that was one of the happiest experiences I've ever had in my profession and in life. It was just a magical experience. Mackinac Island was magic. The movie was just beautiful. We just knew when we were making it, even though it was a small movie, there was something magical about it. We both really believed in the subject matter and loved it. And we also really developed a very, very strong bond between the two of us that lasted until the day he died. So everything about that movie is special to me. And, you know, people talk about doing a remake or a retell or whatever. And I go, no, why? There was just something without trying that happened, that worked, that is. And because it takes place back in the 1800s or whenever it is, early 1900s, I guess, it's always going to be timeless. And since it's about traveling through time, I don't know that you could make it much better than it was. It was just a magical little moment of time, a little movie that no one was ever supposed to see, I don't think, because there was an actor's strike at the time. We weren't allowed to publicize it. You know, the company behind it, Universal, didn't want to promote it particularly. It got the worst reviews known to man and became one of the most beloved love stories of all time. I can't tell you, every day, wherever I go, people stop me on the street, in an airplane, anywhere I am, and they just go on and on about that film, and they tell me that they got married to the music, which, by the way, I was partially responsible for, because John Barry was my best friend and didn't have a budget for that kind of music, and he did it on spec for what they call back-end royalties. So everything that happened there was magic. I'm actually going back to Mackinac June, I think it's 11th or through 13th or 14th, and we're going to do a special kind of thing with the two of my co-stars from Harry Wilde. We're going to do a little special 3 days with Jane at the Grand Hotel. There's places left, but people can look it up. But it's a very magical, magical experience.
Wow. I remember watching James Cameron's Titanic, and I couldn't help but notice similarities to Somewhere in Time, especially at the ending. Both films' characters reunited with their lover in the afterlife. Both featured females living a long, long life while the man dies young. And I'm curious, did you notice these similarities when you watched it, or am I alone? I never talked about it to anybody, but...
Well, I think Titanic came out after us.
Way after, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yes. You know, it is interesting that, and I hadn't thought about that, but I think that's entirely possible. However, in real life, women quite often outlive men. I hate to tell you that.
Right. Oh, no.
But statistically, and, you know, you do hear of, you know, women who have been in, couples who've been in a long, long, long relationship, and the woman outlives the man. And I think this is why it resonates. You know, if you've been in a really long, loving relationship, I think you hope that that can be the case in an afterlife, whether you have faith in it or not. But the truth for me, I'm not specifically religious in any way, but I have actually left my body. I did die, and I was resuscitated when I had anaphylactic shock when they were trying to get me over a really bad bronchitis in a hurry because they wanted me to play Maria. I was playing Maria Callas anyway. I think the story's out there. But what happened is they hit the wrong mark and I got anaphylactic shock. I left my body. Just like in Summer in Time, I saw the white light. It was definitely a place I felt that I wanted to go. But then I looked down and I saw this man screaming and yelling on the phone trying to get an ambulance. And I had syringes in my backside. And I didn't emotionally connect to the trauma at all. It was almost like, oh, that's curious. And meanwhile, the obvious place to go was with this white light. But I chose to go back in my body. And I remember thinking to myself, I've got stuff to do. And the stuff to do was that I wanted to take care of my children, raise them, because they were small at that time. And I wanted to give back. I wanted to make a difference in the world. And, you know, people often say to me, why do you do so much? And I said, well, when you actually have lost your life and come back and you've got that gift, you're so aware of living in the now, how tenuous life is anyway, and why would you waste it? And also, the great gift is I don't fear death. I know the people, because it doesn't hurt, the people around you are the ones that are freaking out. If you look up in the corner of the room, you're more than likely going to connect with, without you realizing it, the one that's passed or is in a coma, because that's clearly where I was. That was my vantage point. And the big getaway was you take two things with you when you die. And that is the love you've shared in your life, or however many times, or however much love you've shared, and the difference you've made. And that's it. You don't take your stuff. You don't take your collectibles. You don't take your prizes. You don't take your money. You don't take your cars. I have news for you. Or your watches while you're at it. No, that's what you take. And it does simplify life enormously. And also, you have a special regard for your health, because now you're looking at your body and you go, okay, this is a vehicle. If I had a car and I wanted it to last as long as possible, I'd have it serviced, oil change. I wouldn't run it into the ground. I'd take care of it. If the tires were wearing out, I'd respect it. And that's basically what we have. We have a body and you have a choice. You can either respect it or disrespect it. If you disrespect it, you can expect to have a painful ride, but you can have a longer, more comfortable ride if you take care of it.
That's so true. I know Somewhere in Time was about time travel and changing life's pathway. If you could go back into time, is there any particular role that you turned down that you would go back in time and accept? Any kicks in the butts, like scuff marks on your rear end? Because you're like, darn, I passed that up. I should have took it.
No.
No?
Absolutely none.
That's great. So you think everything fell into place as it was supposed to?
You know what? I can think of things I aren't necessarily, I look at and I go, oh, why did I do that? But then there was always a reason why, because by doing that, even though it wasn't my kind of material, it was ridiculously successful and enabled me to do something that was my material afterwards, because I was then deemed to be marketable. So, you know, you just never know. I always tell people, you know, you may think you're doing something for one reason and then it ends up being really important in your life for another reason. And same would be said for, you know, Somewhere in Time. Worst reviews ever, ever. Couldn't even get it hardly in theaters because we weren't allowed to promote it. And here we are still talking about it. Same with Dr. Quinn, Medicine Woman. I was guaranteed that would never be a series. And now, of course, I'm on another series, and we've got our third season going right now.
Oh, I know Dr. Quinn, Medicine Woman, it was seen in over 100 countries for 6 seasons, so it definitely was huge. And the cancellation I read led to such a fan uproar that CBS produced 2 follow-up movies. And you're interesting, your character dealt with so many social issues. How do you think the show's message are relevant to today's challenges? And do you see any parallels when you think back to the current events?
Unbelievably current. Because let's think about what we dealt with. We dealt with the plight of the natives, Native Americans, the first people in America. History books back in the not very long back, you know, and Westerns did not really look at what was really going on there, what their culture was, how they'd been displaced, how they're being annihilated. Well, the same thing is happening all over the world with native people. The poisoning of the water with mercury, with gold mining. We are still suffering from that in the Colorado River, where various rivers are polluted because of mining. And we don't recognize the fact that a river is a natural phenomenon. We have to respect, we have to only use as much as we need and not more, and we shouldn't waste water. Water is incredibly important. So the environment. We also dealt with different cultures, the Chinese and their culture, the African-American freed slaves, the Jews that come into town who want to sell things. We have, and then, of course, the very devout Christians, like June Carter Cash played, who's trying to heal everyone and leaving everything up to the Lord. And then, you know, the people who are selling potions in the traveling medical shows that don't work. And then the beginning of photography, the idea of community. We even had the burning of the books. I mean, we're doing that now. The fear-mongering about Ralph Waldo Emerson being gay, and, you know, can you leave a gay man with a young boy? And I mean, you can go on and on and on. And then just to find the idea of the family dynamic, choices in medicine, you know, you may be diagnosed with cancer and there may be treatments for it, but do you have a choice? You know, you may choose not to be treated. You may choose to go with it, or you may choose to take the treatments that there are there. Does the patient have a choice? And then, you know, relationships, being parenting, caring for somebody, trying to persuade people in community to look at things differently. How do you do that? Oh, dealing with venereal disease, all the prostitutes, dealing with addiction, dealing with being blind. I can go on and on and on. I mean, really, every time I look at Dr. Quinn, there is an episode that absolutely is spot on with what we're dealing with today.
Wow, definitely pioneering show ahead of its time. And you're also the executive producer and star of Harry Wilde, currently airing on Acorn TV and BBC America. Share with the listeners that haven't watched it, what's the show about? I believe it's, is it third season now that it's in?
Yes, third season is showing right now, and now for the first time showing on BBC America. So hopefully more people will have a chance to see it. But you can find it through any of the Amazon Prime, Hulu, whatever. It's a very small amount of money for a month's worth of extraordinary material, quite apart from Harry Wilde. But Harry basically is Professor Harriet Wilde. I play Harry, confusing to some people. She's a woman. And she's been a professor of literature, English literature at Trinity in Dublin. In the opening pilot, we see her quit because most of her students are more interested in going to college and partying than actually learning the subject, which she is passionate about. We also see simultaneously a young boy who doesn't want to go to school because he thinks it's a waste of time. And somehow the two of them collide when she, having given up, needs to go and buy herself yet another bottle of red wine. She drinks too much, clearly, and gets her purse grabbed and is sort of mildly injured. Spends some time overnight with her son, who's a detective in the Garda, and realizes that she can solve a crime that he's incapable of solving because she has a knowledge of literature that he doesn't. Tries to help him. He won't be helped. Gets kicked out. And the next thing you know, she is following the real criminal and realizes she has no understanding of the underside, the underbelly of the dark side of Dublin. And so this young boy who's hurt her inadvertently, she now gives him a chance to pay his dues by helping her out. And then, of course, they become a duo. And now, by the third season, they have their own detective agency. And they're solving crimes always way ahead of her son. And it's comedic. It always relates to literature or movies or history that Harry knows. And each crime is more bizarre than the next. It's very comedic. A 16-year-old boy who, while they're pursuing these criminals, she will correct him in his grammar, his pronunciation, and help him pass his final exams at school. All completely insane, really. And then, you know, we have his story of what happened to him in his life and what happened in my life. And it's a wonderful show. They tell me it's one of their top shows. It's sold all over the world. So in a way, I kind of see it like a new Dr. Quinn, but a completely different material. But again, you know, definitely not only entertaining, but very intelligent. Everyone I know in the literary world loves the show. And those were the ones I was afraid of most because I thought, oh, they're going to say, you know, what do you know about literature? But they love it. And I think it's actually making people who never read before or are curious about things like Shakespeare or Emily Bronte or Wuthering Heights. That's weird. Oh, that's weird enough for me to at least, you know, look it up on Google and see if that really happened in that book. And then, wow, that's a weird book. Might be interesting. You know?
Wow, that's so true. Now, you've worked with so many celebrities, I mean, decades. I'm curious, is there anyone in particular that made you starstruck?
I would say Sir John Gielgud because, you know, I was working with him late in his 80s and on War and Remembrance, and he worked with Olivier, he worked with Vivian Leigh, I mean, with everybody. And was the huge star in terms of Shakespeare and the theater, as well as in film. And that was pretty magical to work with him. And I would say the same working with Alan Arkin. What an extraordinary opportunity that was. Starstruck, I loved working with Michael Douglas on Kominsky as well. That was great. You know, I think those are really up there as people that I went, oh my goodness, I've got a lot to learn from these people.
Yeah, I treat a lot of the film industry and, you know, Jamie Lee Curtis, John Travolta, Patrick Swayze, Paul Newman. No big deal. Hey, Paul, how nice to... And then Lindsay Wagner showed up and I was tongue-tied and nervous because I had a crush on her when I was a teenager and I could hardly talk. I remember the Bionic Woman and I'm like, nice to meet me. I was totally starstruck. I couldn't even speak. I was like, she's looking at me like I'm an idiot. So that's interesting. Is anybody on your bucket list that you'd like to work with still?
You know what? I'm very superstitious, and if I say it, it'll never happen because somebody once asked me if there was a film or a play I've always wanted to do, and I mentioned the name of it, and it never happened. So.
Oh, yeah. That sounds good. And now you do artwork, and you explore so many themes of love, loss, and renewal. Share how your personal experiences have shaped these themes and how painting serves as really an outlet for you for your emotions and reflections.
Well, I went through, when I turned 40, I went through a terrible divorce. It was before Dr. Quinn. I'd been kind of nominally called the queen of the miniseries. I mean, every major fantastic role out there, I got one after another. I mean, I got way more than I deserved, but it was an amazing time in my life. And when this whole thing happened and the kind of house of cards just fell apart, I realized I didn't even have time to grieve or be angry or even upset, even though, of course, I was devastated because I had to get my kids to school, et cetera, and keep moving forward. And at that time, my mother had always said to me, and she'd survived World War II in a concentration camp in Indonesia as a Dutch woman back in World War II. She always said to me, darling, everyone in life has challenge. When they do, they close up their heart. And if you do that, it's like a long playing record of misery that you can't get out of. But if you can open your heart, reach out to help someone else, you'll have purpose. When you have purpose, you can move forward. Well, in this case, I was at a fundraiser for a child abuse organization I'd been working with. And I gave the last money I had when I knew I was going to be bankrupt to that organization in return for an artist who was offering to do a drawing or painting of your children. So I did that as a fundraiser thing, knowing I was going to be homeless, have nothing. And that guy taught me how to paint. I told him, I don't have any money. I'm about to lose my home. I literally can't afford anything. And he said, oh, I've got a couple of days here. I'm going to teach you watercolor and you can take it with you for the rest of your life. And sure enough, I do. So once I started painting in watercolor, I couldn't stop. It became my healing. The next thing I knew, one of my, well, maybe my third or fourth ever watercolor ended up in a book called Actors as Artists. The next thing I knew, I was commissioned to do something for a Discover card. And one of my paintings was, three of my paintings were shown at the Guggenheim. And the one that was on the card sold for $25,000 for Make-A-Wish Foundation. And that's when I thought, okay, so this is healing me and it's helping others. And it's something I can do anywhere, anywhere in the world. And so I started painting on sets. I painted on Dr. Quinn almost every day because to stay in character, I can't do crossword puzzles or read something else. And I'm always running my lines. So what I can do at the same time is paint or draw. And so that's what I would do between takes. Then the crew loved them so much, they wanted me to make prints for them, which I did. And then they wanted them on T-shirts, which was so weird, you know, these guys in their army fatigues. And then they'd have a floral or, a, you know, some fish floating around on a T-shirt. It was funny. And then that became like a whole thing. Then I came up with the open heart, you know, philosophy in the form of two hearts that were open, that connected, that I then trademarked and became jewelry with Paige Jewelers at dollars and became a philosophy that now is part of, for the last 11 or 12 years, of a foundation called the Open Hearts Foundation, which I'm really proud of. And now there's monumental statues all over America and Canada. I think it's about nine around the countries, the two countries. In fact, one in Calgary is going up at the end of May, and I'll be there for that. And then my paintings I've now shown in museums and in galleries, and over 2,000 pieces. I thought, well, why not have my art on wearable art? So I now have, if you go to JS Designs or JaneSeymour.com, you'll see scarves, dusters, kimonos, jewelry, everything. Cowboy boots, those have just come out with an open heart on them. I've been designing as well as doing the fine art, which is on the designs. And I love it. It's a passion for me, and it comes from healing. And I think what's important is, when you are going through something that seems insurmountable, like my mom said, you find a purpose. And if your purpose is the ability to help others in what you've been going through, say you've dealt with Alzheimer's, like my friend Kim Campbell, the late Glenn Campbell, she's now a motivational speaker, and she helps people who are going through that path and raises money for those organizations. You know, that's what she's doing. I do it through my art and through my philanthropy and through the things that I produce that I can give back with. But also, art is very healing. Maybe it's writing poetry. Maybe it's writing songs. Maybe it's keeping a journal. Maybe it's talking to others and sharing your story and seeing if your story connects to theirs and therefore, you know, you can help them. And I just made another movie called And You Are, which has just won an award for best film, actually. And it's a short, it's only 18 minutes long, and it's all about a woman with dementia, that's me, and her grandchild, who we eventually realize is not the granddaughter that she remembers, is now a young man. And so it deals with two issues that people don't really understand and don't know how to deal with. But the point of the movie, and it's so moving, is that one can only live in the past, one woman with dementia, and the young person who's now a trans boy does not want to remember their past. They are only interested in being in the present because now they feel they are who they always were. It's a very powerful and beautiful movie that I also hope will be seen by lots of people. But that's the kind of thing I do now. I want to make stories and art, and I want to find a way to connect with people and help people go through the journeys they're going through, whatever that journey may be.
Yeah, that's awesome. You definitely paint from the heart. I've seen some of your work. It's fantastic. Time just flew by. I got one more question I have to ask. You look fantastic at 73. What is your secret? Share a quick tidbit. Do you have a Fountain of Youth skincare product, diet, anti-aging supplement? What's the secret here?
Okay. In terms of skincare, for the last 12 years, I've been using something called Crepe Erase. I know that the commercials and everything are out there. People see it, and then they come up to me and they say, does that really work? And I go, yes. And they come up and they touch my arms and they look at my décolleté and my face and they go, wow. And I go, yep, that is what I use. And that is what I use all the time, every single day. And I think it's the number one selling skincare in America right now. But for a good reason, it works.
What's it called? Say it again. Say it again for those who didn't hear it.
Crepe Erase. Crepe Erase. I am a great believer in, anyway, whether you're using that or not, in really having clean skin before you go to bed at night, especially since I have to wear makeup for films and things. And I don't do anything permanent. There's no tattoos or anything like that on me. I have nothing against anyone doing those things. But in my profession, I need to have, I feel like I'm a blank canvas. And if I want to play Ruby, I need to have all body parts moving, including all the frowns. So I tend not to kind of want to change my face. I want it to move. I want to be able to show grief and fear and anxiety and trauma, and at the same time to look as good as I can as well. So I do exercise. I do a combination of isometrics. Basically, I would just say a lot of yoga type moves. I've had a bad back in the past, so I'm really careful about doing things carefully and slowly. I was a dancer, so I do a lot of ballet type things, lots of TAs and ballet kind of stretches. When I can, I do Pilates and gyrotonics, very similar kinds of resistance kind of training. But pretty much everything I do, I can do without having to go to a gym as well. And I really love being able to show people what they can do, even if they don't have time. If they're waiting for a cup of coffee, waiting for the kettle to boil, you can do all kinds of things in the kitchen, just using your body weight and putting your hands on a table and bending your knees and then using your arms to lift yourself up and down, things like that. Hair, I wash my hair every day and condition it. I try to stay out of the sun. That's why I've created these hats that you'll see online with Wallaroo that have 50% sunblock because it's incredibly important. And I think mentally, you know, I was open to finding love again, and I did. And I am in a wonderful, giving, loving relationship that is just incredible. And I think by letting people know that's possible, I'm kind of, there's a lot of women, especially who after the age of 40 or especially 50, kind of give up. And I'm saying, don't give up. Just move the dial. Try something different. Be the person you didn't have time to be when you were raising kids or you were married or you know, whatever was going on, or you had that job that you didn't have time for. I'm trying to kind of open people up to realizing that you do not live in the past. The past is gone. Now is everything. I spoke to my best friend today who's paralyzed from the neck down. She was a ballerina, my best friend. I spoke to her today and she's lying in the hospital and she just said, Jane, now. It's not yesterday. It's not tomorrow. It's this minute right now. She said, that is what I have to tell you. She said, just love whatever circumstances you're in. Love now. Be in that moment. And so that is the message I pass on to anyone. And I think if you're in the now, you know, you can smell the roses, you can look at this world we're in, you can find a way to help someone else that will help you, making you feel good about yourself. You can enjoy your grandchildren if you're lucky enough to have them. You can grow some vegetables in a little pot on your balcony, whatever it is. just realize how precious life is, and that's it. That's my takeaway.
Wow, such great advice there. I'm sure people took some good notes. That's your secret. I love it, and you're glowing with it. So, hey, do what she does. I mean, you've got proof that it works.
Oh, you know what? I know everyone's, you know, talking about Ozempic and all of that kind of stuff. I don't do that either. I intermittent fast. I honestly, it works for me. So if I have put on a few more pounds than I choose to, I intermittent fast. That's what I do. I give my body the chance to regroup and the cells to do what the body can do so well. And we do it with a computer. We refresh. Just refresh your body. It's very simple to do. You just don't eat late at night and you don't eat first thing in the morning and you give your body 15 hours to just refresh. And then you make healthy choices. Mediterranean diet is always good. We all know processed food is bad. We know white flour, white sugar, white anything, white rice. Just stick to what we all know is good for you and take your supplements as well.
Yeah, it's well said. I call it the white loss diet. Get off the white foods and you'll lose some weight. The flour, the salt, the sugar, the processed stuff. Fantastic advice. It's been such a pleasure having you on the show. I wish you continued success in all your endeavors. And the film is called Ruby's Choice. It's available on a multitude of streaming services, including Amazon, Apple TV, Fandango, Vimeo, and Google Play. You can also watch it on video on demand at most major U.S. and Canada cable and satellite providers. It's a wonderful little film. I hope everybody takes advantage of watching it. It's very, very heartfelt. And to learn more about Jane Seymour, you can go to janeseymour.com and you can follow her on Facebook and Instagram at Jane Seymour. For my daily health tidbits, humor, and culinary advice, you can follow me on Facebook at Dr. David Friedman. On Instagram, I'm at Dr. D. Friedman. If you heard something today that you'd like to share with somebody you know, send them a link to this podcast. It's available to yourgoodhealthradio.com and RadioMD.com, and peruse our podcast library and share these segments of interest with your friends, family, coworkers, and on social media. As I always say, sharing is caring. Don't keep this information to yourself. And you can also subscribe to podcasts on Apple, Spotify, and iHeartRadio. More to come. Stay tuned and stay well.